I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more timely and fascinating books out now is Like War, the Weaponization of Social Media. Through the ubiquity of social media in our society, there has been a weaponization of not only the technology and the various platforms, but the people online themselves. One of the book's authors, P.W. Singer, joins me now. In the book, he and Emerson T. Brooking talk about how terrorists live-stream their attacks, how Twitter wars produce real-life casualties, and how disinformation has altered the fate of nations. The tactics used online between ISIS and Taylor Swift or Kanye West are the same. I'll ask Mr. Singer about those, as well as Donald Trump and how his use of social media has hastened his rise to the presidency and how it fuels him and his supporters daily. Peter Singer is a strategist at New America and a consultant for the U.S. military, intelligence community, and Hollywood. He's written several best-selling books, including Wired for War and Ghost Fleet. His website is at pwsinger.com. Like War is an Eamon Dolan book published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Peter Singer. Mr. Singer, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I'm sure you're asked this a lot, Peter, about the title of the book, Like War. I mean, if you had to explain to someone what that means, I guess it has two meanings, doesn't it?
Yes, it's like so much else in this space. It's a bit of a play on words. So Like War is, in one way, the idea of the battles back and forth online kind of meld the internet, war, and politics and news in new ways. So they are like war, and in many ways Clausewitz would recognize some of the lessons of it. But then also the very idea of a like war is one in which you have these competing armies, whether it is ISIS versus the U.S. military and its allies and coalitions, or it's Trump fans versus Hillary fans, or it's Kanye West fans versus Taylor Swift fans. All of them are competing to drive their idea viral through a mix of likes and sometimes lies. And so it's this, and a different way of putting it is, if cyber war is the hacking of networks, like war is the hacking of people on the networks.
And so do you think those of us online realize how we're being used, say?
Unfortunately not. And it works in two ways. One, we are the targets of these conflicts. They are battling for our attention. They're battling for our opinion. They're battling to take that and turn it into real-world action. And so you are simultaneously being targeted by, you know, everything from marketing wars, political campaigns, people trying to sell you a product, sell you a candidate, even real wars, trying to sell you one side or the other of what's playing out in Afghanistan. So we are targets in all of it, but we are simultaneously combatants because our clicks decide not only our own reaction to it. And again, your clicks go beyond that because they affect how you think about something. They also affect how you think about it well into the future. So as an example, something we explored in a piece for the Globe and Mail was about the conspiracy theories that surround the anti-vaxxer movement, the wrong idea that vaccines don't work or that they create other diseases, and how that has led to actually a return of several diseases that we thought we had solved. You know, so in this way, social media has become both a national security but also a public health security issue. But what's interesting is the data shows that if you've been taken in by one conspiracy theory, one bit of fake news, you're actually more susceptible to other ones in the future, even if they have nothing to do with it.
Right.
So you have that. So your clicks not only decide for yourself, but they also decide for your friends, your family, everyone else in your network, and they decide what goes viral or not overall on the internet. And the problem, from what we explored in the book, is we're online. The vast majority of us are online, and yet we don't understand the new basic rules of the game.
Right.
And so as a result, we're being taken advantage of. In many ways, I can make the parallel to a game of poker. If you sit, and this is from the movie Rounders, if you sit down at the poker table and you don't know who the mark is, you're the mark.
Right. Now, so I mean, 10 years ago, we would say, well, how do you get, how do you best protect children before they get on the internet? But at the same time, I mean, you need to know. I mean, it's everybody now. It's adults and especially say older people who are susceptible to scams online and the sort. I mean, so what do you advise people in terms of the public best girding themselves from say being a victim or even just a bystander? Because I mean, that's a terrible thing too, to be just say a witness online of something terrible, right?
Yes, absolutely. And in many ways, I like this idea of the parallel of public health, because when you think about public health, there's a role at multiple levels. There's a role for government, there's a role for private industry, and there's your own personal hygiene and the like, and what you teach your kids in terms of their hygiene. And it's the same. And no one would say, "Oh, there's you know, the government will take care of all health-related issues. I don't have to wash my hands or cover my mouth when I cough." But in turn, no one would say, "Oh, well, I cover my mouth when I cough. I guess there's no need for a hospital, or there's no need for medical research." It's the same phenomena when we talk about this space of online. There's definitely things that government can and should do, and in particular, there's models of what other nations have done, for example, the Baltics, to better protect their populace from disinformation threats and the like, while still preserving rights, democracy, et cetera. So, you know, this is not something where you have to see calls for censorship or the like. There's very reasonable, easy things that have been done in countries like Estonia. Unfortunately, I'm speaking to you from the United States, we're at the opposite end of the spectrum. We're the nation that invented the internet, and now we're the example that everyone uses of what not to do. So you've got a role for government. You've got more that's needed from the private companies. Go into that. But then you have your own personal role. And there's lots of different things, but mainly it comes down to our conduct online in an area known as lateral. So moving outside of the information sources that you use, always connecting to different ones, moving across information rather than down it and across the communities that you are in. It sounds complex. Essentially, it reflects a lesson that came about roughly 4,000 years before the internet was invented. It's the tale of the blind man and the elephant, how each blind man believes that he alone has found the truth. And he touches the elephant. This is a wall. Another one touches, no. This is a snake. And he's touching the elephant's trunk. It's only by gathering all the different perspectives that they truly get at the truth. And that's the same phenomena today when we think about our conduct online. And then again, in a parallel to public health, it's not just about protecting you. It's about protecting everyone else in your network. And so thinking about that responsibility as a good example, more than half of the articles that are retweeted and shared online are never read by the person that shared them.
Right. Yeah.
We're just using it for kind of signaling.
Yeah.
And of course that then, you know, is another way of pushing this information out wider.
Yeah. Yeah. You touched on a moment ago, the responsibility that say the companies themselves, the social media companies, and they're in the news a lot in terms of Facebook especially and their conduct. Twitter, their responsibility that they bear in terms of, say, protecting their users. I mean, when you think of Facebook and Twitter in particular, was it their own failure, say, or their own negligence? Or was it just, say, I guess society writ large with a lack of regulation, say?
So one of the sort of fun experiences of this book project was going around interviewing all sorts of different people to get their perspectives on this. And so everything from the literal creators of the internet itself, and you know what has happened to your creation. When did you first realize it was going to turn into this social thing, and then now this political thing? To extremist group recruiters, to reality stars who taught us on how you manipulate the media, to extremist group recruiters, to tech company executives. And one of the patterns that emerged, to answer your question in terms of the companies themselves, is I liken them to almost akin to parents going through the stages of grief at what happened to their babies, at what happened to their creations. They set out to invent cool technology and to make a lot of money. That's essentially the backstory of all of these. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, for example, was a college student who built software to allow other students to rate who was hot or not. That's the origin of Facebook. And now they're put into these roles, and this is, again, one of the other changes that the book explores, where they're some of the most powerful figures in all of politics and war today. They make decisions that tilt the playing field one way or the other in terms of shaping the outcome of an election, of deciding whether a terror group is allowed to have a voice to inspire other people, to recruit other people, whether, to give a real-world example, whether generals in Myanmar should be allowed to coordinate mass killings or not. This gets decided by essentially a handful of what were tech geeks. And so over the course of this, they essentially go through the stages of first denial that both good but also bad things are playing out on their networks and that maybe they bear some responsibility for them. You can see, for example, in the wake of the Russian disinformation campaign targeting the 2016 U.S. election, Zuckerberg says it's a, quote, pretty crazy idea that this was really a big problem and it really could have influenced people's vote. And he's saying that simultaneous to when Facebook is advertising to political campaigns. It's telling the strategists of political campaigns, we are the best place to influence how people vote. Mm. And Facebook has all the data to show that it's better to advertise with them than TV, radio, et cetera. So they go from kind of denial to now they're in the period of sort of mild acceptance but bargaining, where they're certainly doing a lot more. And, you know, one of the big what-ifs is what if they had done this earlier? But there still is a fair amount to go. And there's a lot of different measures that they can and should put in place to better protect their own customers. And so you see that kind of playing out within the companies right now.
Yeah, and that's something that I didn't realize until I read your book, is that the Internet, it's in its adolescence. And so it has to experience, I guess, these growing pains. And unfortunately, there's a lot of, say, stuff that goes along with growing pains, as any, you know, institution or person say. And I guess we just didn't realize that, did we?
There's part of that, of the parallel of adolescence, of kind of this great gain in power and responsibility, but you're still kind of gangly and uncertain of what to do, and, you know, growing into that role. And this is one of the other changes that is different, even within Internet history, is that for most of Internet history, there was this real vibrancy in, you know, new companies. Essentially, you know, every couple of years, there's a new company that you know, there's sort of a cycle, and they're washed away. So you may remember Six Degrees or Friendster, and then it was MySpace.
Right.
Well, now we're seeing it kind of lock in. These mega-sized companies are here for the long term. There's a variety of reasons why the Facebooks and the Googles are not going to be washed away quickly like, you know, MySpace was.
Yeah.
Some of it's because they've kind of created such a large structure that everyone has to go through them. Another is basically they're able to buy up competitors that might rival them. So, you know, sometimes, for example, young people will say, oh, well, you know, Facebook, I'm not on that. That's from my grandparents.
Yeah.
I'm on Instagram. And you're like, who do you think I was?
Right.
So that also points to how we all, you know, given this is going to lock in, we all need to understand the rules of the game because we're going to be part of it. And it's going to continue to shape our politics moving forward. Again, whether it's the election of a prime minister or the rise of a extremist group, these will play out within social media, and so we have to understand it. But in turn, it also, again, ripples down to your own personal life. The rules of the game of what drives something viral, you know, what was fascinating is how the very same attributes played out, whether the goal was to drive information about a war viral, or, you know, another example in the book was how Taylor Swift has won at her battles and driven her message viral and recruited her, you know, kind of version of an online army. And so you get these wonderfully strange parallels that are there that, you know, hopefully both inform but also entertain.
Yeah, and I mean, you do that, and that's what makes this book so engaging and so interesting is you talk about, say, how Taylor Swift is able to harness her audience and her voice. And then you talk about, say, Mosul and what's happening there, what happened there, I should say. You begin the book by talking about Donald Trump's first tweet, and that's not too long ago, come to think of it. And look where we are today. We're halfway through his presidency. He serves as a useful example.
Hopefully.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Halfway through his term, I should say, his first term.
I liked your version better.
I could say that as a Canadian, yeah. He serves as a useful example because he's someone who, I guess, I mean, did he really know that he could harness social media to its ends? Or do you think he was a guy who was co-opted by people outside of him and then, you know, I guess drawn to use Twitter for the purposes that he's used it for, say?
Yeah, we use the opening of Trump's very first tweet, not only just because it's a fun, fascinating story,
yeah,
but it also illustrates this idea that, you know, the rules have changed and it's helped change the world. That, you know, someone who you never at the time would have thought would become president. It was literally, you know, a joke. And then you move forward, and he's using the very same account to announce that he has become president. And, you know, then it follows with the story of ISIS doing something the exact opposite of what any military would have done in the past, about to launch an invasion. And, you know, normally you want to keep the invasion secret. You think of D-Day, the Battle of Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
By contrast, ISIS creates a hashtag that's literally hashtag all eyes on ISIS. It wants the world to watch because it's wrapped up in its strategy. And it's, you know, examples like that that kick off the book of showing, you know, hey, the world has changed. These moments that would have once been unthinkable take us into a new space. And they also show how what plays out online really does matter to the real world, whether it's Trump mobilizing what played out online to help win the presidency, or ISIS using it to, you know, create to take over a city to convince 30,000 people to join it to inspire acts of terrorism inside the U.S., inside Canada, et cetera. So for Trump himself, I think it's a bit of a combination, and we can see that through his history.
Mm.
I went back and read all the old Trump tweets so that you don't have to. And so there's a pattern from when he first starts on Twitter, and it's not all that, you know, to use his own terminology, it's not all that energetic, it's low energy.
Yeah.
It's mostly for marketing. It's announcing upcoming appearances. It's not all that inspirational quotes. You know, and the marketing is literally things like, you know, keychain giveaways and Trump brand mattresses. But then something happens, and it's something that actually happens to most of us. He grows addicted. And there is a frequency change, and then there's a tonal change, and there's a timing change. You know, this is when he begins his famous, you know, kind of tweeting and the hours of the night. And this is probably where his just sort of natural personality fits in as well. So, you know, among the things that he starts early on is he starts what are known as flame wars. He gets into arguments in front of the world. And if you go back in time, you know, this is pretty remarkable. It was pretty different. You have a someone who's claiming to be a great businessman, and yet he's getting into a shouty argument like a teenager with everyone watching online. But it gives him what he craves, which is attention. And he then starts to seek out more and more targets, and his eye also starts to turn to politics. And this is when he starts the period of attacking the president himself, who just a couple years earlier he had praised. Now he's floating internet conspiracy theories. And again, he's get the key thing of social media is not only do you become personally addicted, but you get feedback. That feedback adds to the addiction. He's getting more and more reactions to this. And he also begins to test out ideas, experimentation online. You get to see what works or not immediately. And, you know, basically this is becomes part of his shift into politics and his rise. And, you know, one of the people that we interviewed was a top political strategist in the United States, and he ticked through all the different ways that Trump should not have won according to the old rules of the game, all the disadvantages that he had and the advantages that, you know, first his Republican rivals and then Hillary Clinton had against them. And then he basically says, you know, but these didn't matter anymore. Because the game had shifted, and Trump himself personally credits social media with this. But you know, one of the things that the book hopefully unlocks is understanding the difference between Trump's personal strategy, his Twitter approach, that of course has just kind of consumed us, but also the Trump campaign strategy, which by contrast mostly played out on Facebook. And what's important is, while a lot of leaders are now copying Trump's Twitter strategy, the bigger impact into all our lives is that side of the campaign strategy, where there was a mirroring between what the Trump campaign did, the approaches of media companies like BuzzFeed or the like, and that's the one that you're definitely going to see more and more of. Obviously, we can come up with like examples of individuals in Canadian politics who might be kind of trying to do some of the things that Trump himself does on Twitter, shouty or, but I guarantee you, the campaign strategy, that part, that's everyone's going to be doing that, whichever side of the aisle they're on.
Yeah. What we're days away from the midterm elections in the United States, and you talk in the book about say, what happened in 2016. What's going to happen this year in terms of whether the effect of meddling in 2016, will that happen this time around, say?
It has continued. There's obviously a debate on the impact of these disinformation activities stemming from Russia. And it's interesting, it's a debate that's playing out both in the United States but also in Great Britain, because the activities also targeted Brexit. And there were two very close elections. The historians can have that debate, and the political scientists, and we'll never be able to resolve it without a time machine. But there is one thing that we do know. The attackers think it worked because they're back for more, or rather they never stopped. And so we've seen the very same accounts, the very same tactics continue on. In the United States, for example, they've glommed on to controversies that range from the Charlottesville protests involving neo-Nazis to there's a controversy around the anthem and playing at the football game, the American football, the NFL game. There's basically kind of jumping into anything and everything where they can cause division and rancor. And that we've now seen elements of that in targeting the election. It's not as effective, arguably, because circling back to a prior question, it's been harder for them to do because the tech companies have put into place measures that weren't there in 2016. The scale of it, for example, on Facebook in 2016, we now know was enormous. U.S. citizens, 146 million U.S. citizens saw the Russian disinformation content on their Facebook feed. Wow. That's half the population.
Yeah.
Now that's not as that scale, that amount is not possible anymore because the measures Facebook has put in. However, you know, we've seen kind of just like any good military strategy, you know, when you face a good defense in one area, you move over to another. So we've seen it move into areas like Reddit, or we've seen attempts at indirect efforts. For example, trying to echo chamber out internal voices that are the Russians view as particularly divisive. A lot of the members, sort of the key conspiracy theorists behind things like Pizzagate, et cetera, we now have the documentation that Russian accounts were trying to give them a megaphone, give them a larger online presence than they would have had on their own. So it's continuing, but importantly, this is a key. Other actors look at it and say, huh, that worked. That was relatively cheap. We can do it too. And those other actors might be other nations. There's examples of like war activities committed by an Iran. They might be other political parties. The Brazilian election right now is seeing almost all the same kind of activities hit it. It might be activist groups. It might be even a single-issue millionaire who really cares about a local election, whatever. The tactics are available to all. And that's the part where we really have to catch up to this, because it's not just a Russian phenomena. It's not just a United States phenomena. It is very much a global issue, and it's very much one, again, that doesn't just play at the level of governments. It moves all the way down.
So as I finish the book, the one thing that I was wondering, and I'll ask this of you as we wrap up our conversation, Peter, is are you hopeful that social media can be a place of meaningful social interaction, of connection, or thoughtful discussion, or have we long past that point now?
I want to and try to be fair-minded, not too much of a pessimist, not too much of an optimist on this, because at the end of the day, not just social media, but every single technology has been used for both good and bad.
Yeah.
By good and bad people. All the way back to, you know, the very first stone picked up by someone was, you know, either used to bash someone else in the head or build the very first fire ring. And so with social media, we see both. And indeed, in the book, we always try to give illustrations of good and bad uses, good and bad characters. So, you know, for every story about a terrorist recruiter, you have a story about, a young teenager who's been empowered to, you know, one of my favorite stories in the book is this little girl who became a reporter in her small town. When the newspaper closed, she set up her own online newspaper, and, you know, the first story she posts is about the birth of her baby brother. You know, not too many people going to read that. But she moves on, and she actually covers the very first murder in the town in over a generation. And the police tell her, you know, they try and get her not to report it. And she says, you know, no, I'm a journalist. You can't tell me what to do. She was age 9.
Yeah.
Sort of great, fun stories. You also get the darker side. And that, to me, is really, and maybe this is the appropriate ending point for it, is that the question of which side wins out is up to us.
Mm.
This is a space where our clicks, our views decide. And so we will determine whether the good or the bad side wins out. We will determine whether it is the truth or whether it is alternative facts, fake news, disinformation, however you want to frame it, whether it's the mistruth that went out. We get to decide. So, you know, hopefully that's a both a maybe a positive way to end on, but also a little bit of a call to action.
It's an important book that you and Mr. Brooking have written. It's a necessary one, but also, as I said a moment ago, an engaging one, but also a useful one. Congratulations on continued good luck with it. I could talk all day with you. This has been fun for me. Thanks for this, Peter.
Thank you so much. Take care.
The book is called Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Co-written with Emerson T. Brooking, Peter Sinker. Join me on the line from Washington, D.C. and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.